It is an ocean current that flows south along the coast from Canada to Baja, and it brought to the people who would come to live along the coast unbelievable living treasures to plunder. Plunder they did. And so today we pause to ask, do you think we can learn how to preserve the fish in our sea?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1425th edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Townsville. Or tune in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we went fishing a few days ago. Though we did not catch a fish, we did catch an incredible experience. Early in the morning, we motored out of Moss Landing Harbor into the Monterey Bay and headed for the Soquel Hole, which is an offshoot of the Monterey Bay Marine Canyon, and it's locally famous as a salmon fishery. The water was very still that morning, with little sign of life, which is very unusual for this body of water. We trolled for 3 hours with all the various baits in the box, with not a single bite. Oh well, they do call it fishing, not catching. On our way back to the harbor, we spotted some whale-watching boats off towards Monterey. Our captain remarked, "I wonder if they are on a blue whale. I have always wanted to see a blue whale. Let's go see." And so we went to see. No whales. But we did find ourselves in the middle of a huge pod of orcas. Just off the starboard side of the boat, the mothers had schooled up what looked about to be about 15 to 20 calves, and were teaching the young how to slap the water with their fins in order to scare fish and communicate with the family. The calves were having the time of their lives, leaping out of the water and chasing each other up and down and all around. Reminded me of a bunch of young puppies playing. But just then, on the port side of this boat, the adults started leaping clear out of the water to show the young how to really have fun. The adults, who were bigger than I thought they possibly could be, leapt clear out of the water to land with a splash so close to the boat I thought I was going to be washed overboard. But their show was so spectacular, I simply could not turn away. Though mesmerized by the moment, I did have one thought. So, this is why the fish are not biting in the Monterey Bay today. With that little story, I would like to introduce the man who tells the very big story about the great ocean current that has brought unbelievable living riches to the California coast. He is Joe Ogilvie. He is a chef and author of Tin Can Coast, A History of Industry, Greed, and Fishing in the Golden State. Joe, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great story you just told.
You have a very big story, and it is very well told. And as the author of Tales from a Tin Can, a World War II history, what first captured my attention about your new book was the title, Tin Can Coast. And when I looked into your title, I realized that, my goodness, we both wrote war stories. But it gets right down to it. For those who have never been to Monterey or have never read any John Steinbeck, what is Tin Can about the California coast?
So it's kind of, there's, I mean, really the title is kind of about this, it's a reference to this, this moment of, well, it's just this huge boom in sardine canning, and also in Monterey and a few other places up and down the coast, but also in tuna canning by the south. And they kind of, you know, I think to a certain extent, a lot of the California coast was kind of shaped around these canning industries and these fishing industries. In Monterey, most famously, most notably, but also a lot of Los Angeles, a lot of San Diego, were kind of those cities and the way of life in those cities were kind of shaped by, by what they caught and what they canned and what they put in the cans.
It's actually a pretty big turning point in our culinary history when we started eating fish out of cans.
Yeah, and that was a kind of one of the things I didn't know very much about when I started this was the history of where canning came from and what it kind of the history of that and why how it started. And it's still it's kind of strange when you start thinking about it, this idea of eating a sardine or eating cooked tuna out of it's been in a metal canister for a year or 2 years or whatever. And one of the things I kind of when I was that I was looking at and I was finding out a lot about was this the way that canning moved from being kind of high tech, it was kind of food of the future is what they took on the polar expeditions. And it kind of moved over time to being well, in America, to being a kind of much more of a kind of mass market for the mass market consumer, particularly after the Civil War, when people would send, you'd send care package, tinned fish or tinned foods were a great care package to send someone fighting the Civil War, and I think the canning. Kind of becomes this way of capturing the abundance of particularly California capturing this kind of huge natural abundance that's swimming around in the oceans or indeed in the fruit orchards kind of onshore capturing abundance and then finding a way to get it
Sell
to the
it.
people in the cities that need it.
Yeah, sell it and make money with it too.
And sell it and make money.
Well, do you remember the moment you really decided that this story had to be told? If it was it relating to the fact that you're a chef as well as a writer?
Yeah, there's kind of, I guess there's kind of two, there's kind of, there's these two, there's kind of two moments. The first was, and the one that kind of provided the kind of emotional backdrop to it, I guess, is. Being in a restaurant, being in the kind of basement prep kitchen of a restaurant in it was actually in London at the time, and my part of my job was basically cleaning and prepping fish, and we'd get 30 pounds of sardines, 10 pounds, 15 pounds of squid, mackerel, chondro, all kinds coming in, and I had to clean them, I had to gut them, scale them, all of that. And after I'd done, I don't know, half a ton of this, half a ton of these fish, I started thinking kind of, where are they all coming from? I'm doing this in one restaurant. There's 100 restaurants in London doing this. There's 100 restaurant, 100 cities around the world doing this. Kind of what's going on
Well,
with this? Where are they all coming from? What's happening? And so that
why
was the kind of,
California?
and then so then yeah, that was kind of thing. That I've, at that point, I'm thinking about kind of fish and where that's coming from. And then, a while a little bit later than that, I was reading a book about I was reading a book about the history of fertilizer,
Well.
and of. It was reading, but yeah, this book about the history of fertilizer and how that kind of, that had that shift in agriculture came around. And just in a kind of brief aside, they mentioned that in California, they used to catch sardines and grind them up and use that as fertilizer before they invented, synthetic
Synthetic
like
nitrogen, yeah.
nitrogen. And that kind of, that there's something thought that's a weird thought. It's a very strange thought to be taking this fish that's, great to eat, and then kind of breaking it down, grinding it up, spreading on the fields. It was also kind of elaborate. And then it was also kind of chimed with, I'd always loved Cannery Row. It was a very important book to me growing up. And so, this suddenly reading this moment of everyone catching sardines and grinding them up kind of recast what I thought, what I'd known about County Road. Suddenly what had been a sort of fun, jolly story about the kind of
Sure.
bums, noble philosophers and,
And
hijinks on Monterey.
the interesting thing, Joe, is that you thought of this, and California writers didn't think of that writing this book, which is interesting to me. We're here looking at it, we didn't see it. And you're in London not looking at it, but you did see it. Now, one of the things that really captivated my attention while reading through the Tin Can Coast was the ecologist Garrett Hardin's concept of the tragedy of the commons, in which he suggests a situation where individuals, acting on their own self-interest, overuse and deplete a shared resource, ultimately harming and maybe even destroying the commons. Does that ring true with what you saw as the history of fishing and the California coast?
I think there were, I mean, the sort of short answer is yes, but there is also, and I think there are many kind of, there are definitely examples of it in the book. But I think one of the things that I was quite interested by, quite heartened by, was this idea that there were also, you also kind of come across counter examples where there were people who managed to kind of who did manage to conserve their commons. I mean, the famous thing with the tragedy of the commons is that in Britain those commons lasted for before 500 years, and similarly in California there were groups and there were communities, particularly the Chumash, who kind of and I think they all kind of, yeah, it's very great, heartening to see counterexamples
Good.
of
Well,
to that
that's certainly
tragedy.
something we want to hear as we go along. And you did populate your book with several very good examples of that. So, ladies and gentlemen, today we're taking a very interesting look at the Tin Can Coast, by virtue of the book, The Tin Can Coast, by Joseph Ogilvie. And it is a look at the California coast and the riches that were brought to this coast, complements of the California Current. And when we're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, I'd like to start with that California Current and talk about the riches that it indeed did bring to the California coast, and how those riches really started the civilization here in California long, long, long time ago. So this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking the Tin Can Coast of California. Didn't know you had one. It does. So please do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back to the Tin Can Coast. We're talking about California. And it does have a tin can coast, at least it did at one time. Not so much anymore, but it was a very rich history and made famous in part by John Steinbeck, Cannery Row. And it was a big part of California culture for quite some time. A lot of it's disappeared. But let's go back to the California Current to talk about that incredible flow of water that brought California and the West Coast such an incredible abundance of living treasures. Joe Ogilvie, California Current.
Yeah, so the California Current is it's this kind of this big, it's like 1900 miles kind of flowing from around Vancouver Island all the way down to about halfway down Baja California. And then about there, it takes a kind of turn and turns. So it flows south down there, and then it takes a turn and goes, starts flowing west.
Is this part of the Northern Pacific Gyre? Which,
Exactly, it's the
yeah.
kind of eastern boundary of the Northern Pacific Gyre. It's so if you imagine that as a kind of big clockwise kind of movement of water around the Pacific, this is its eastern boundary, and it's basically kind of it's the southern flowing body of water, and it's very very cold, and it's very very and it's very very kind of rich in nutrients, and kind of because it's kind of got this much colder water than you would find at somewhere else at the same latitude. It kind of gives rise to this huge abundance of well, originally of algae, and then the plankton that eat the algae, and then little sardines and sardines that eat the plankton, and then from there into kind of all kinds of everything from salmon to seabirds to sea lions and the orcas and the whales that you were kind of that you were looking for on your fishing trip, and yeah, that is that's that kind of brings that's where this kind of huge natural abundance comes from.
And on the east coast of the United States, the f water flows the other way.
Yeah, and so because of
Because it's
that,
on the
it's
west side of the gyre, correct? And so
exactly.
the water flow is warmer instead of colder, and thus it doesn't contain quite the nutrient flow that the California Current has. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. You're getting warmer water from the tropics, rather than this kind of cooler water from up in the last up. There's another aspect that's a bit more technical to do with the way that the southern movement kind of the water kind of diverts a little bit, and as it comes up, you get nutrients kind of flowing up from the seabed, and that kind of brings even more even more richness to to the current.
So, with respect to the West Coast of the United States, we're blessed by that California Current as it brings cold water, cold nutrient-rich water to the coast, and thus spawns an incredible amount of life because the food chain is complete and everybody's eating and everybody's happy. Big fish eating little fish.
Exactly.
As it were. And so kind of take us along the Pacific coast and tell us a little bit about the sea life that predominates and has been made use of. For example, up in the Pacific Northwest, it rains a lot. And so you have a lot of salmon in that neck of the woods, right?
Yeah, kind of yeah, these big salmon runs coming in because of that kind of all along along the Western Pacific coast, you get these kelp forests, because of the cold water, and the kelp forest is a really fantastic kind of ecosystem for all kinds of edible and non-edible fish and sea slugs and crabs, sea urchins, huge numbers of different kind of different animals. And abalone, which is one of the things that I kind of focused on quite a
Yes,
lot.
you do. You also make mention of the Kelp Highway.
Yeah, so the Kelp Highway, I think, is one of the things that really kind of blew my mind when I found out about it. Kelp Highway is a kind of is this. If you can imagine, if you imagine there's an arc, an arc from sort of roughly, northern Japan going up around Siberia all the way, sort of down Alaska, down the Pacific Northwest, and into California. They've all got these same. They've got very similar kelp forests. And one of the kind of that are very full of food, very full of kind of resources that one can make a one could make a life from. And I think one of I think it's fair to say the kind of probably the one of probably the dominant theory of how the very first Americans came from East. From Eastern Asia into the Americas was by kind of essentially following these kelp resources from from island to island, from shoreline to shoreline, kind of around this arc of around this kind of this arc, this one arc stretching from Japan to California. And because it's this they're similar kelp for it, they're similar ecosystems,
Relearn.
they didn't have to relearn, they didn't have to come up with new technologies and new ways of living, new systems of life. And so that I think a lot of our kind of thing comes to the conclusion that that's that's actually a much more likely way that people came into Americas in the very first place. They were following the fishing.
And another story to introduce the life on the coast that I found very interesting, of course, was your treatment of the sea otters, and how the sea otters brought people essentially along the same kelp highway along the Aleutian Islands, or from Siberia along the Aleutian Islands and down the coast.
Yeah, so there were these in this kind of strange I guess a sort of a sort of perverse recreation of the Kelp Highway. The same kind of arc is followed by Russian fur hunters, fur trappers, who were basically who were in search of sea otter fur, very, very soft. Quite amazing. It's got an amazing aesthetic, and so they pretty much followed this same kelp highway all the way into California. In the, I think they reached California in 1813, and they were probably they first kind of crossed the Bering Sea in 1760s or so.
The interesting thing about the hunt for the sea otter, and it should we should make mention of the fact that what made the sea otter coat so attractive to the fur trade was the incredible warmth of the pelt itself. It was said that it was said in your book that there are up to 1 million hair follicles per what per square inch. Oh, we're talking about the sea otters. And the reason they were so valuable in the fur trade is that their hides had an incredible density to their hair structure. You said up to 1 million follicle hair follicles per square inch or something like that. Okay, we're talking about the incredible effort it took to go from Russia all the way to California to hunt sea otters. And what happened as a consequence of that? Joe Ogilvie, why were the sea otters so valued in the fur trade?
The short answer is that the Chinese the Chinese imperial court, which was kind of had kind of developed this interest in
in sort of as a way of kind of trimming the dragon robes, the kind of ceremonial robes they wore for courtly life. And the Chinese imperial court, they were interested in them. And then European and Russian traders were very interested in the goods that the Chinese court could supply, I guess it was. And so they were coming to, they were taking these furs, taking them to China, swapping them for things like tea, china, porcelain, that kind of silk very often, and then shipping that back to Europe or to Russia. And so that was kind of what, it's this kind of strange transferring, Californian otter fur into silk to go and sell in Moscow, which is a big kind of trans global network.
And the consequence of that is that these furs became so valuable that a huge industry was set up, and the sea otters that were then hunted pretty much to extinction.
Pretty nearly, pretty close to extinction. I mean, I think for quite a long time, it was thought that for quite a long time, it was thought that sea otters were extinct in California. They kind of knew they'd survived elsewhere in Alaska and in a few other places in their range, but people really thought that, there were no more sea otters in California. And it was only in, there were a few people, there were a few kind of fish and game scientists who knew there where there were one or two, but they kept it quiet because they basically they didn't want them the last ones to go. And it was only in the 1930s that people that they were kind of rediscovered as a kind of live group. And in Big Sur, which until then had been very remote and kind of cut off from people, and it was a kind of great place for these sea otters to thrive. And then since then, they've come back, and within quite a narrow bit of range, they're thriving, and I think they're quite abundant. Within the section.
Yeah, one was seen to be attacking surfers in Santa Cruz, so that was a pretty good indication that they're on the way
That's a good
back.
sign.
But you know, this your story of what happened in the trade for sea otters was really quite, it was a good parallel to what happened to the bison on the Great Plains. And they were just hunted down for the robes and skinned and left to rot in the sun. And pretty much the same thing happened to the otters. And yet we have figured out ways of watching over them, so they're now repopulating. And they have a lot to do with the kelp highway too, don't they? The otters themselves.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we didn't know at the time, but we've kind of has really come across, is that otters are kind of, in a way, they're the kind of architects of the kelp forest, particularly in more northern waters, because the otters they've got a huge appetite for shellfish and for abalone and for sea urchins in particular, and when they, basically, see if you leave sea urchins unchecked, they'll kind of graze off all the kelp, and after a certain time you'll be left with what's called an urchin barren, where there's nothing there but urchins. The kelp's all been grazed off. But if you bring in sea otters, they'll feed on the urchins and kind of keep their numbers in check so that the kelp can flourish and can thrive. And so as the sea otters disappeared, as the sea otters disappeared, you got these urchin barrens kind of rising up along the coast.
And there you go, you have a balance. And so we have a balance. And that seems to be what your story is all about, the Tin Can Coast, and how we've lost that balance but how we're trying to bring it back. When we come back from this break, I'd like to ask Joe Ogilvie about one of my favorite Tin Can Coast locations, and that, of course, is Monterey, California. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio program, Michael Olson with Joe Ogilvie, who is the author of The Tin Can Coast of California. You didn't think there was one, but there certainly was. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, many of us have read, and the rest of us should, John Steinbeck's account of Cannery Row. What a wonderful story. And it is a wonderful place. And even to this day, Cannery Row has become one of the nation's premier, or at least West Coast premier, tourist locations. It even houses the Monterey Bay Marine Canyon, or Marine facility, the institute, as well as the Monterey Aquarium, which is probably world-class aquarium. And when it gets right down to it, the Monterey Bay area, the Monterey Bay itself, is quite a marine sanctuary. So take us back to those days, Joe Ogilvie of Cannery Row and John Steinbeck.
Yeah, so the kind of Cannery Row kind of started in just after the very, very earliest start of kind of origins of it are in kind of 1902, when this, you know, really when the salmon runs up in the hills had kind of those salmon runs had been overfished, or and a lot of the rivers had been kind of silted out, and so many less salmon than kind of the gold rush time. And so these canners were looking for something new, and they moved down into Monterey initially to try and catch kind of juvenile salmon. And then they started realizing, you know, why not go for sardines? You know, there's the whole bay is full of them. And I think the kind of, you know, that kind of started, but then the kind of the next big shift in it was when was a lot of Sicilians moved into Monterey, and because they had a very long history of catching sardines and using a very specific net called a lamprey net. But once they all kind of moved in, and they kind of revolutionized the actual catching of the fish and the catching the sardines. But I think the big boom and the moment when kind of Cannery Row becomes Cannery Row is during World War One, because there was suddenly this kind of call for cheap rations. All the, you know, the European fisheries had closed down because of the war, and so there was, you know, they needed as many tinned fish as they could get, and you know, all these new canneries were being built, and largely because of the odor, and also to kind of keep, I guess I would say the town fathers and town council wanted to keep the smells and also the workers that were coming into these new canneries kind of separated from the rest of Monterey, which, you know, had a bit of a kind of a tourist or a leisure aspect to it as a town. They moved them into this one section of Ocean View Avenue that very quickly everyone began calling Cannery Row. And so that was the kind of, you know, that was the kind of, that was where it really started, and that was where it took off. But then the next big shift was after the war, when these rations kind of suddenly there was no more interest in rations. The European fisheries were back online, and they began what's called reduction. And that's kind of when you take a whole fish, we take fish waste, and you you press the oil out of it, you grind it up, you bake it, and kind grind that up again. And eventually you're left with fish meal and fish oil. And there was much, you can use fish oil for all kinds of things. You can use it for making soap, making paint, making newspaper ink. And fish meal is a very good fertilizer, but it's also a very good chicken feed for the kind of battery farm chickens that were becoming a part of California's agriculture at that time. And that's the kind of, I think that's the kind of big shift in County Rose. Suddenly, you would take, you're catching these fish, catching what had been kind of, what had just been used for tin sardines, and kind of turning them into commodities, or turning them into kind of raw materials for, for the kind of for an industrial society.
How long did they last?
Once they started reduction, they lasted, that was in probably 1918, and they lasted until 1945.
Enough.
1945, which was the last kind of good year for the sardine industry in Monterey. And it was also the year that Steinbeck released Cannery Row. So he's kind of written, ended up accidentally writing a kind of eulogy for the industry and almost for Monterey as a fishing town.
So much of your book deals with the plunder, I guess, of natural resources, just like the sardine, just like the sea otter, just like everything that had a commercial value when it gets right down to it, was plundered almost to extinction. But you point out the fact that maybe we'll learn how to preserve the fish in our sea if we develop some good conservation practices. And we do see sardines in the Monterey Bay now. I can attest to that. They make good fish bait, and I eat them too. So they're not extinct. But one wonders, as you wrote this book and you look across the oceans of the world, there are some threatening signs that the tragedy of the commons, as it were, continues. And I'm thinking principally of the Chinese fishing fleets that travel the world, distant water fishing fleets. It is said that China's distant water fleets, which are fishing fleets that fish all over the world, 96 different in the waters of 96 different countries. The Chinese fleets consist of 57,000 vessels with 17,000 specialized factory processing boats. And the China now catches somewhere between 25 and 50% of the world's catch and fishes. So as I read Tin Can Coast and how we Californians pretty much plundered everything that we could plunder to make some bucks. And I see China doing the same thing on a massive scale. Where do you see this taking us? Can we come to grips with gaining control of the commons of our oceans?
I mean, I think, and I think one, I mean, I think in recent years, California's done quite a good job of kind of trying to protect these kind of commons, trying to get these, trying to protect its waters. And I think actually, in a lot of ways, California's in a better place than a lot of nations or a lot of states, well, perhaps nations rather than states. But I think, as you say, there's the huge problem of the shadow fleets of the China of Chinese in Chinese fishing in international waters and kind of pirate fishing in other countries' waters. And I think the other aspect that is becoming very difficult is the warming ocean, and the acidification of the ocean. And I think, in a funny way, that's a sort of equally
Right.
difficult, an equally difficult challenge, because it's something that kind of it's everything is everyone's sort of implicated in, and it's kind of changing. It's changing these oceans and these commons from the bottom up.
It's a different way of plundering the commons, but
Exactly.
it is plundering when you use it up indiscriminately. It's just plunder. You can graze your sheep on the grass, and they can eat the grass, and they can also dig up the ground and ruin the ground. So, we have to figure out some way of coming to grips with the fact that we have to. The good book tells us to take dominion of the birds in the air and the fish in the sea and the animals on the land. And but dominion means that we have to take responsibility for them. And the most difficult thing I see with respect to the commons is that they are the commons, and who is going to take responsibility for them?
And I think one of the things I was kind of heartened by was, when I was doing research, was kind of researching and writing this book, was the communities and the peoples who had kind of had found a way to kind of to kind of take responsibility for these commons and for these kind of shared resources. People like, well, the Chumash people in on the Channel Islands and across the Channel Islands Strait, who for almost kind of 12,000 years had kind of managed to, they didn't they used these resources, and they kind of they depended on them, but at no point did they crash them, because they kind of knew they'd be the ones who paid the price of that. And I think there are other moments, the Chinese abalone fishery, that for example, they had this kind of, so they kind of came up with kind of ways of kind of taking collective responsibility and coordinating, so that they didn't kind of over, so that they could kind of take responsibility for their actions and kind of share responsibility for their actions and think about the consequences that would happen. And I think one of the very sad things about the Chinese abalone fishery, that was kind of it was kind of closed off by racially targeted conservation laws and the kind of general anti-Chinese feeling on the West Coast. But one of the things that's very sad about that being closed off was that they were kind of feeling their way towards a kind of I don't know, towards a kind of an answer to that kind of that question of how do you kind of take responsibility for the
And they
commons.
were engaged in the abalone.
And so they were engaged in the abalone fishery, which is abalone, those big sea snails with a the wide shell, and they were the kind of abalone fishery, harvesting abalone, became a kind of almost a kind of haven for the Chinese American communities in California. No one else was particularly interested in it. It was kind of they were
Well, they
free
were.
from competition, and they were kind of free to kind of create their own.
Nobody here was eating abalone. So they were sending him back to China.
So they sent it back to China, but I don't think it, they said they would send it back to China, where it's a kind of delicacy. And they'd sell it in the Chinatowns in San Francisco as well, a little bit. But they'd kind of they were kind of they were coming to a kind of place of how do we maintain this resource that's kind of sustaining our community, and thinking, what do we, how do we live with the consequences of, or how do we make sure that we don't over harvest it, because we're the ones that will have to live with the
Yeah.
consequences.
And we're the only ones here, and if we don't take care of it, it'll be gone. And if it
Exactly.
is gone, I often think about what the American Plains Indians thought as they watched the great slaughter of the bison on the on the prairie, and wow, that's our food that's being shot and left there. But it is a very interesting story that you wrote, Joseph Ogilvie, the Tin Can Coast, California. California's Tin Can Coast. I never thought of it as such until you brought it up. And yet I live right across the bay from Cannery Row, and that's what the term came from, tin cans. And it really signaled a time in which we took the fish out of the sea, put them in a can, and could eat them whenever we want. And we still do it today. We still have fish to eat, and we're grateful for that. And hopefully, we'll figure out some way of husbanding the resources that we have in the fish of the sea. And if you give the Tin Can Coast a read, you'll probably join that effort to preserve what we have left. Joseph Ogilvie, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain, and thank you so much for the work you put in writing the Tin Can Coast. It's a good read, it's well researched, and there's lots of good stories in there about California that even we Californians don't even think about enough. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been the Food Chain, and stay tuned for more next week. What's eating what? Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.